Welcome to The Protagonistas, a podcast that is centered on highlighting the stories and experiences of Black, Indigenous, and other women of color among communities of faith. Our conversations sit at the intersection of race, gender, sexuality, and spirituality. I'm your host, Kat Armas.
Hola, 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 friends. How are you all doing? So it is officially less than 1 month until the release of Sacred Belonging, and I am so thrilled and also so humbled that my words will be out in the world. Okay, I do not take this lightly. Words are weighty. They have been the bearers of worlds, holding within them a multiplicity of meanings. Strung together, little black marks on a white page stir something in us. They ignite our souls and whisper to us secrets we've always longed to hear. Words can make us sweat, cry, laugh. They can be smelled and tasted, heard and felt. They are magic. And the fact that you get to read or listen to mine is truly an honor. I do not at all take lightly. So I want to say a little bit more about words, but before I do, I want to welcome you to The Protagonistas. So the weightiness of words is precisely what makes the Bible, I think, such a powerful tool, because it too is a book of words, authoritative, sacred words written in languages and cultures not our own, translated and interpreted so that we may understand and apply its principles timelessly. But as we know, like many other things in this world, a lot gets lost in translation. So one example I often think of is John 1:1. So the first time I read it in English, it captivated me. In the beginning was the Word. Now, a few descriptions of Jesus stand out so powerfully to me, particularly because of my love for words. But understanding the weight of them makes this description all the more compelling. It wasn't long, however, before this verse was stripped of its beauty when the Word, in many of the evangelical circles I was a part of, was replaced with the Bible. In the beginning was the Word, or the Bible, many Christians asserted, and the English version of the Protestant Bible at that. But growing up with Spanish as my first language, I understood John 1:1 entirely different. The version I became familiar with reads, "En el principio ya existía el verbo," which translates to, "In the beginning already existed the verb," which to me is just as incredible, maybe even more, as Jesus as the Word. Jesus, the verb of God, the action of God. This, friends, is the image of Jesus I knew from a young age that also shaped my understanding of him and of spirituality and of my faith. Now, so much can be said about these descriptions, but I'm thinking about the difference in translation specifically and how it speaks to the power that language holds, how the divine spirit makes herself known to differing groups of people in unique and intimate ways. Jesus is a word and also a verb, a transcendent picture of the mystery, the wildness of God, and also the expansive nature of Scripture. But here's something else I learned that makes this all the more incredible. Did you know that in Greek, the word logos, which is the word that is translated as word in English in John 1:1 and in other places, was first used in reference to cosmology? It was developed to conceptualize the interconnectedness of the universe, how all things work together as one collective whole. Later, the Greeks used it to describe the relationship between all things as a sacred or divine process of dialogue, a cosmic conversation, if you will. And what's beautiful is that this too is how the earliest Bible commentators translated John 1:1 to Latin. In the beginning was the sermo, which means discourse, a dynamic and lively dialogue. Now we get a better picture, a better idea of the power this word holds when we look at its root word, which is sero, which means a weaving together. Sermo, then, is a joining together of ideas, words, thoughts, and processes. It is an intimate and dynamic conversation. Friends, this is how Logos was understood in the earliest days. So if you were to ask me to do a translation of this verse that takes into consideration these translations that I just talked about, or these words that I just talked about, I'd say something like, in the beginning was the conversation between all things, the cosmic dialogue that speaks to us about all that we are. This conversation was with God and was God. Now I think of it as those kinds of conversations we have every once in a while that change us. Not the ones that happen most of the time, right? Like intersecting monologues between two or more people where each person is waiting for their turn to talk. No, instead, this kind of conversation is the one you have where you hear yourself saying things you didn't realize you knew, you didn't realize you felt or even thought. These are the conversations you have where the words you hear from someone else awaken something dormant in you. They burrow into the crevices of your soul and you think, that's it. That's exactly it. These are the conversations that dance in your mind for years after they become a part of who you are and who you will become. For me, a few of these conversations actually happened in a parked car at some point in the middle of the night. I remember one of them. I was in college and unsure of what I wanted to do in my career, and I just felt sort of lost as a young adult. And in one of these kinds of conversations, my friend spoke something to my soul that gave me clarity. It changed the course of my life entirely. The next day, I went into the registrar's office and I changed my degree track. And really, I mean, my life took a different shape and a different form and a different direction after that conversation. I remember another one of these conversations I had with my now spouse before we were married. It was a little while after we met when we felt like something was starting to feel off about the faith we thought we knew. Well, the theology we held so deeply. And in one of these late night parked car conversations, we began our deconstruction journey without even realizing it at the moment. But it was the first time someone else really understood and felt the thing I had been feeling but wasn't sure how to articulate. I'm sure many of you listening have had similar experiences with friends or sometimes even with strangers. I actually think those are the best kinds of enlightening conversations. And if you think about it, Jesus had many of these conversations with folks all the time. And many of them were strangers. So while I will forever love the idea of Jesus as a word, because I love words, of course, and while I will always cherish the notion of Jesus as a verb, because amen to Jesus as the action of God, the notion of Jesus as a conversation bears life-altering theological weight, particularly against a culture that often clings to a God that is fixed and static, a disconnected sky god that judges and condemns, one that is perpetually disappointed in us, a god of monologues, only of lectures. But instead, it is the Logos, the dynamic, transcendent, interconnected, relational force, the conversation to whom we belong. It is in this dynamic and intimate back and forth, friends, where we find our home. It is this God who burrows into the crevices of our souls and makes us think, that's it. That's exactly it. And what I love about this kind of God is that it mirrors, or better, it establishes the kind of connection and relationship available to us in the natural world. I was reminded of this the other day when my spouse walked in one morning with our first egg. Now I'll explain. It had been several months since we began raising our first flock of chickens. And if you follow me on Instagram, you might have met them at some point. But we had been anticipating them laying their first egg. So when Taylor walked in with a tiny olive green beauty, I squealed. He cracked the egg into a bowl for his breakfast as soon as I set it down after gawking at it for way too long. And all I could think of was Robin Wall Kimmerer's words about how loving the earth changes you. It empowers you to protect and defend and celebrate and enjoy her, but that relationship deepens. It takes on a new level when you feel that the natural world loves you back. When that reciprocity finds a home within you, altering your reality and how you experience it. You see, when we truly feel the natural world loving us back, talking, conversing right back to us, is when we move from a simple, perhaps even simplistic relationship toward a bond enlivened by divinity, a connection that now becomes sacred and liberating and healing. But the thing is that humanity hasn't always had a history of loving the natural world. In fact, for the dominant culture specifically, its relationship to the natural world has been the opposite. One marked by ravaging and pillaging, polluting and devastating, littering and poisoning, a relationship of domination. Christianity in particular has often perpetuated this logic by misunderstanding the command in Genesis 1:26 that calls us to have, quote, dominion over life on earth. Now, the word dominion in this context, like the word logos, has long been misused by those hungry for power, looking for any excuse to exert control as they wish. It is often invoked to support the notions of conquering and enslavement of plants, animals, and people. But what if our contemporary renderings of dominion, like logos, have been misguided? Theologian Ellen Davis argues that part of what makes dominion tricky to understand is the preposition translated in English as over. A better one, she suggests, is among or with respect to. And while dominion has long been understood as domination, a more accurate definition is something akin to exercising skilled mastery. This suggests something like a craft or an art that considers the place of unique responsibility humans have in the cosmos, in the cosmic conversation. Friends, this is the honorable task we are given as a species, the responsibility to represent God's tender and compassionate, skilled mastery with respect to the world. We are to stand for God's justice even when it stands in the way of our self-interest. And doing so leads not just to the flourishing of creation, but to our own flourishing as well, a flourishing rooted in divine reciprocity, in a back and forth, like the kinds of conversations I was referring to. This is a flourishing that can only be experienced when we understand how mutually dependent we are on each other. And in essence, this is what an abuelita theology is all about too. We don't just serve the dominated, the oppressed, the marginalized as an act of mere charity, although yes, we should be charitable people. It goes further and deeper than that though. We undo power dynamics in our world by being served and loved back in mutuality. It takes a vulnerability and a humility to not just give, but to receive in a relationship of reciprocity. The tenderness of the world begins to change us when we allow her gifts and ultimately her sacred and divine wisdom to do a work in us. This is true of the land, and this is also true of our neighbor. Makes me think of the story in the Bible I'm sure you've heard of, the story of the Canaanite mother, or as I write in Abuelita Faith, the Canaanite mama, who called out to Jesus for help because her daughter was ill and suffering. And you can read this in Matthew 15, verses 21 through 28. Now, most of the time when people talk about or critique this story, it's often in an attempt to figure out what Jesus meant when his initial response to this woman's desperation was to call her a dog. Indeed, Jesus makes an alarming, seemingly out of character comment to this woman after she asks for his help. He says, "It's not good to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." Now, countless books and commentaries have tried to guess why in the world Jesus would have said this, and they oftentimes engage in some sort of apologetic defense. But one thing remains true in the telling and retelling of this passage. More often than not, this desperate, unnamed mama gets pushed to the background of her own story. Her significance is ignored, and this amplifies the marginalizing tendencies not only of the biblical text, but also of critical scholarship and theological interpretation. And while I too am very curious to understand Jesus's comment, I'm also curious to learn and celebrate what it is about this unnamed mother that makes Jesus later praise her as someone who possessed, quote, great faith, something he had yet to say even to his own disciples. Not only does Jesus engage with her and other marginalized women, like the Samaritan woman, but their conversation is such that Jesus is challenged and transformed by her as much as he challenges and even transforms her. You see, after he calls her a dog, the Canaanite mother responds, defends herself, does not take no for an answer, and engages with Jesus in a type of dialogue or a conversation that holds the agency of both. It's a mutual and reciprocal tension that allows for both Jesus and the woman to be transformed. And friends, what's so beautiful is that they not only transform each other, but also the world in which they are co-creators. I think the fact that we are still talking about it right now is proof of that. Jesus transformed people, but he was also transformed. This is the reciprocal, the lively, the dynamic, conversational relationship we are to have, not only with the divine and the sacred, but with every living thing on this planet. So my spouse walked in with yet another egg from our sweet hen later that evening, and I was still beaming with the joy it is to revel in this relationship. And a couple weeks later, and I'm still reveling in what it means to know I am secure and safe in this relationship. To know that every time I step outside, the bugs, yes, even the ticks I dread with every ounce of my being, and the wildflowers and the birds and the wild turkeys and the deer and the bullfrogs and my cat and the herbs in my garden and my neighbors down the road and my toddler and you name it, all play an integral role in this world. I need them to do their part as much as they need me to do mine. I need their wisdom in order to be whole. This is the relationship available to us, and this would be true even if we did not accept nature's invitation to enter into this sacred bond. But doing so, humbly entering into this reciprocity like a wanted guest at a celebration feast, makes living and being human all the more meaningful and all the more beautiful, because here is where we are transformed. In this conversation, this back and forth, like Jesus and the Canaanite mama. So I set the egg down on the counter and I whispered with a smile, "We nurture the natural world and she nurtures us right back." A reciprocity, a conversation, a gratitude that knows no bounds. An action, a verb, and a word. Sending so much love to you all. Thank you for listening.